This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Brandon Contes.
All righty. Welcome to episode 26 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Contes. And this week we have SportsCenter legend, radio icon, and now author of the occasionally accurate annals of football, Dan Patrick, joining us. Dan, thanks so much for coming on the podcast today. Should we refer to this appearance as part of your retirement tour or part of your book tour?
Probably a little combo platter. By the way, who picked the music? It sounds like it's out of a 1970s cop show or something.
I think that's exactly what we were going for.
I like it. Nailed it there.
So how did you end up teaming with Joel Cohen, longtime Simpsons writer for this book? Whose idea was it?
It was Joel's, but he had called me and he said, are you interested in being an announcer on The Simpsons? And I said, yeah, as long as I'm not playing myself, absolutely. He goes, yeah, you're just a regular announcer and it's Homer in a rock skipping contest. I said, awesome, I'm all in. And then we just started talking and went back and forth on some things. And then he had some sports questions. And understand that a lot of people, not everybody has a podcast. It may feel that way. But he said, look, I got these questions. And then he started asking questions that had to do with the butt fumble, you know, the Patriots mascot, like just crazy things. And then I started going back with him with some of my answers. And I could tell he was a very bright guy. And then he said, I'm going to write these down. Would you be interested in doing a book? And I said, yeah. But I didn't think it was going to happen. I just thought, yeah, I'd be interested in that. More importantly, I'm excited about doing the Simpsons episode. And then he sent some things back. And then I sent some things back. And then all of a sudden he goes, do you care if I take it, you know, to a publisher and see if they'd publish it? And I go, sure, go ahead. Knock yourself out. And he came back. He goes, we have a couple of different publishers interested. And then I was like, oh, shit. Now we got to write a book here. And it's been a great experience, and he was so much fun to work with. Just talked to him again today, and he might want to do another sport, maybe college football, maybe we do baseball down the road.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I love the occasional book with some big font. Like I see big font, and I automatically feel like this is going to be a fun read.
Yeah.
Did you help come up with the format for the book, or were you more so just kind of like asked to weigh in on topics and questions?
Oh, there was nothing off limits. It was like, let's throw everything against the wall, and even stuff that doesn't stick, we'll try to throw it up there again and see if it sticks. And each team is represented. We got players represented. He had Andy Richter work with Conan, who wanted to, you know, do a chapter. A lot of his friends were like, hey, can we be involved in it to a certain degree? And I said, yeah. So we just kind of threw it all in the blender. But yeah, I came up with a lot of topics, chapter topics, even different athletes to put in. And once again, nothing was off limits because you're not really burdened by truth. You know, you can still have fun. We took poetic license with this. And most of your NFL books are very serious. It's about, you know, gladiators and the decades and the teams and, you know, John Facenda's voice, you can hear it, but we wanted to kind of poke fun at our love of the NFL.
Yeah. I think I'm now always going to have the vision of Brett Favre sitting on the bench in 2010, reacting to finding out that you still get paid even if you don't play. Like that reading that now, every time I see Brett Favre, I'm just going to like imagine him going through having that conversation with his teammates. Have you ever been asked to write a book forward for somebody?
I have. I've declined.
Cause I was very surprised. I was surprised to see at the beginning of the book, obviously, that you said that you didn't know what a book forward should look like. I was even more so surprised that Adam Sandler said he didn't know what one should look like, just cause I would have assumed that Adam Sandler has probably been asked to write them before. I would think that he probably has written them before, or at least he's put his name on a book forward for somebody.
Well, I was aware of what a forward was, but I was trying to explain it to Sandler. And I just said, you just write until you stop writing. and write whatever you want to write. And then he said, well, can I write about how much I hate the Patriots? I said, sure. And then he, I don't know, a couple of days later, he goes, Danny, I changed it. I'm going to write about how much I love the Jets. I don't want to have people think that I hate the Patriots. I hate the Patriots, but I don't hate Tom Brady. And I said, okay. And then he just wrote. And then it was like 48 hours later, he sent it to me. He goes, is this good? I said, looks like I didn't care. It was just write whatever you, he grew up in New Hampshire and was a Jets fan. I said, go ahead. And I know that he loves the Jets and he hates the Patriots. And certainly being up in New Hampshire, having to deal with that. But at the time when he was in New Hampshire, New England wasn't consistently good, but you know, I was happy that he was willing to do that.
Who do you think is going to have a more extensive book tour, you or Stephen A. Smith?
Oh, I think Stephen A. I think he's been on his book tour for, I don't know, six months, a year.
I think it's been over a year now.
Yeah. I mean, at some point, if you buy the book, great. If you don't buy the book, that's okay. We've had some interest from people who may want to make it into a TV show.
Okay.
So that's something that's happened recently, which is kind of exciting. And but no, I did the big show with Keith Olbermann, and we didn't have much of a book tour. We just thought if you wanted to buy it, great. If not, we don't want to guilt you into doing it. And you know, that's the way I feel about this. I'm proud of it. If you buy it, great. If not, it's okay.
Yeah, I did, and I personally enjoyed it. I thought it was a very entertaining, easy, fun read. And like you said, it's definitely different from the more serious NFL books that are out there. But that's a good thing. Were you surprised the way the retirement stuff took off over the summer when you announced your plans to retire in 4 years, or more so that you tried to announce that you signed a 4-year contract extension?
Yeah. You know, when I'm on the show, I'm just talking to the Danettes, and then you don't realize there are people listening and maybe writing this down and or reporting on it. And then when the show was over, I was, you know, I immediately went, oh my God, I just did a disservice to, I'm signing a contract 4 more years, and then after that, that's going to be my last contract. Now, if I say it that way, it doesn't have anywhere near the magnitude of I'm retiring. And even my wife said, she texted me and she goes, are you retiring and not telling me? I go, in 4.5 years, hon. And she goes, oh, okay. Because people don't read everything. We assume that they go, well, of course they're going to read through this. It's like Dan Patrick announces his retirement. They didn't follow, you know, get the following line of in 4.5 years. But that's on me, that I should have put that out front, that I have a new contract and then I'm retiring in 4.5 years.
Does it almost feel good that the retirement stuff took off? Like if it just went ignored, then it kind of means that people don't care. But like you sort of announced your retirement in 4 years and in 4 years and people still freaked out about it.
Yeah. Look, how people react is how they react. I can't control that. We have a show that has a huge following. Those are the people I'm talking to. I'm not talking to people outside of that. And how, if somebody covers it, great. If they don't, it's okay. I don't take it personally. If I'm, you know, I was in mainstream when I did SportsCenter, and you know, I was doing the 11 o'clock SportsCenter. Anything you did or said or involved in made news. It was a big deal because you were on SportsCenter. Now I'm not on SportsCenter. I'm on a streaming service with Peacock. We're on nearly 400 radio stations and a huge podcast following. That's the only audience I care. Whereas before at SportsCenter, I couldn't control anything. It was, you know what? This could get out of control if you say something about somebody on a show, or you're doing something at the ESPYs, or you do a Sunday night conversation. Now it's just my audience. That's all I care about.
Is there a concern as you get older that you will almost become somebody on that, or someone that social media is almost like looking to find mistakes that they can point out and make fun of? Because it feels like Twitter sometimes declares that somebody has expired before they actually expire. And I think I would mention Al Michaels and Bob Costas as examples of that.
Well, to be grouped in with them, I'm fine with that. And those are two of the greatest broadcasters in history. And if you're waiting around for mistakes, you got a sad life. I won three consecutive Marconi Awards as the best national radio host in America. So I'd like to think I'm still at the top of my game, but I'm also realistic about it. I don't want to be laughed at. I want to be laughed with. I want to make sure that I'm doing my job, being relevant, doing interviews, bringing up topics. I want to make sure that I go out that way. And that was part of the reason. I don't want to hang on to hang on. I still have a broadcasting school. Sandler puts me in his movies. I have a lot of other interests there. So if 4 years, it'll come quickly, and hopefully I'm able to go in the way I came out.
I kind of, when it was announced that Andrew Perloff was going to be leaving your show for CBS Sports Radio in 2021, I had in the back of my mind that I thought that might signal that meant that you were going to retire soon. So I wasn't necessarily stunned about the retirement announcement. I was pleasantly surprised by the 4 years. I just don't know how you already know that 4 more years is going to be enough.
I just, it feels like it.
Yeah.
I have 4 kids. I have 1 grandchild. I just feel like I want to be able to do things in 4 years. I don't want to retire and then have time and not be able to do it physically. But this is every day. I love the grind every day. A lot of people go to a golf course and want to play golf. I want to go to the range and hit golf balls. I love every single day coming in here. And even when it's Saturday and Sunday, I still come in here. This is home. This is something that we built, and I'm very proud to have this show. And it felt like, and I thought about this at the end of my SportsCenter tenure. I wasn't enjoying it, and I will not go through the motions. I will not. Somebody else should be doing it. And I truly thought that when I did the 6 o'clock SportsCenter, I wasn't enjoying it. I had better hours to be able to be with my family, but there was no juice there anymore. And, I put that on me as well, but that's when I first realized it hit me during a 6 o'clock SportsCenter that it was time to go. I didn't know where I was going. I knew that I would have a lot of offers, but I still wanted to go to some place doing something that really challenged me. SportsCenter challenged me when I did the 11 o'clock. And then I looked around and I go, Keith's gone. Berman's gone. Bob Lee's not doing it. Run down the list of everybody. Kilbourne's gone. Stuart Scott was still there. Rich was gone. Kenny Mayne. I looked around and I go, I'm the old man in the building. And I decided then that I was going to leave.
Why do you think that wasn't? Because I feel like being the sort of old man in the building and the last person of that group to still be there could almost be more, make it feel more challenging to have a long lasting relationship with SportsCenter and ESPN.
But it wasn't difficult, and you get complacent. It became formulaic, and I just thought, nope, not going to do this. Doing the 11 o'clock where it's live and you're doing these highlights live, a lot of the highlights, 60% of the highlights, we didn't even get to see before we did them. You probably had 70% of the show that was ad lib, and there was a high every single time you did that. The 6 o'clock, everything's done from the day before, or you're previewing, that'll happen that night. And there wasn't that feeling that you want. It's like, when you play a sporting event and you get ready to go out, there's that nervous energy. And I had that when I did the 11 o'clock and the 6 o'clock, I just didn't. And, I said to one of my bosses, somebody younger should be sitting in this chair, plain and simple. And then, they laughed it off and I go, no, I'm being serious. I'm not challenged and I shouldn't be sitting in a chair where somebody else can get an opportunity.
Is radio your favorite outlet?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Because it's the last real true form of communicating with an audience. Because first of all, if I say something, you have to do the visualization. So there's a reciprocation. If I say something about Tiger Woods, you immediately have Tiger Woods in your head. You can text the show, you can email the show, you can call the show in real time. And I like that. There's a relationship that's one-on-one, even though it's really one and a couple of million each day. So it's different, but there's an intimacy to that. And you allow me into your car or your office or your home, just like SportsCenter. I mean, when you think about it, the 11 o'clock SportsCenter, we're in your home. We could be in your bedroom. We could be in your living room, your den, man cave, but we're there. And I just remember how I met a woman one time and she said, keep talking. She was listening to me. She said, keep talking. And I go, about what? She goes, no, you're in my bedroom. And I go, what? And she goes, no, my husband has, you're on a show. Keep talking. And I kept talking. And then she said, you're on SportsCenter. So your voice is what I'm allowed in your head. I'm allowed in your home. And I always appreciate that. I never take it for granted that somebody takes the time out during their day to allow you into their day. And it's never lost on me. It's a great compliment.
Did you make a conscious decision at some point to make your producers part of the radio show? Like, did you always want that cast of contributors, or did it happen organically?
No, I knew what I wanted. The second time around when I did this, when I did radio at ESPN, I was doing ESPN radio. And I thought that I was really just kind of voicing things for ESPN, ESPN games coming up, ESPN analysts coming on. And it wasn't reflective of what I wanted to do. And I thought if I ever did it again, that I wanted to have a studio audience, but the studio audience, their employees, and they can respond to me. And I didn't want them to be professional. I wanted them to be just regular people. And I've known Paulie and Seton and Fritzy for over 20 years. And then Marvin took McLovin's place. But this really started listening to the Howard Stern show. That Howard, I thought, the best thing that he does is he makes you interested in people that you never thought you'd be interested in. And that's the people that work for him. And all of a sudden, I'm caring about Sal and Richard or Ronnie. And I just thought, Fritzy is the most unique person in sports radio. Paulie is there's no better producer. And Seton's business acumen. Then I bring in Marvin, who's a younger voice. He's funny. He's very sharp. And so you're giving people four different personalities. And it's up to me to bring out that personality. But they bring out my personality as well. So that's where the game plan started. It was Howard with what he does with, you know, some of his employees.
Do you still listen to Howard?
I do. Yeah.
Do you miss what Stern was in the 90s, the early 2000s, even 10 years ago, or do you more so respect his ability to evolve?
Well, I love when you leave it to the imagination, because that can be really powerful. And I thought Howard, when he towed the line, occasionally went over the line, but when he towed the line, it was up to me to interpret it, what he was saying, and or what it looked like, what it felt like. And to me, that was really, really strong and powerful. Now, you know, there's no censor. You can do whatever you want. And sometimes you lose a little bit of that mystery there. But, you know, Howard has evolved. His interests have evolved. His show has evolved. His interviewing has evolved. And so it's a different show than what it once was.
You're the radio host of choice for a lot of entertainers and comedians. Is there an added pressure to kind of live up to the fact that people like Adam Sandler and Will Ferrell think that you're funny and entertaining?
No, because I don't change when they're on. I will say that those are two of the more selfless, big-time celebrities I've ever met, that they will listen to what you have to say. They don't have to be the funniest guy. And when they come on, it feels like they kind of get up to speed of what we're doing and they blend right in. But no, I don't feel any, I mean, I put pressure on myself just to have an entertaining show. But I don't go, oh, I got to step up my game and Will Ferrell's on and it, as quick as he is, let me see if I can keep up with him.
Yeah.
I don't try to do that. I learned that being around Bill Murray back in the mid-90s, early 90s. Let comedians be comedians. Don't try to be a comedian. If you say something funny, great. But I know my place, and that is let them do what they do, and I'll do what I do.
Do you enjoy being in Adam Sandler movies? What was the first one that he asked you to do?
I did Waterboy, and then I did Longest Yard. Because I did Waterboy, and then I told him, I said, if I could play something else in a movie, then I'd prefer that. And then he said, you're going to be a cop in my next movie, and your name is Danny McEffin Patrick, and you're going to have a mustache. And I said, okay. And I'm in Longest Yard playing a cop with a mustache, and he'll write a scene for me. And I think I've been in over 20 movies, but he'll just say, hey, I got a character for you. And I can't stay on set for a long period of time because of my day job, but he'll do something where I come in for a day or two and then I leave, and he'll write something specifically for me if he can. And he's been very generous over the years with putting me in his movies.
Do you like acting? Is that something that you ever kind of thought that you were interested in doing, or did you just kind of stumble into it with Sandler?
I don't like the process of being on set for hours and not doing anything. And then you get on set and then you do a scene and then you're done. Just the whole buildup, the waiting of it would drive me crazy. But there's a challenge to it. It's fun, but I'm glad I don't do it for a living.
Compared to the the creative freedom that radio offers, was hosting Sports Center enough of a creative outlet for you?
At that time, but I was doing radio, ESPN radio at the time. I never wanted to give up radio. It's in my bones. I have two brothers that were in radio, and I grew up, you know, that's how I listened to the Cincinnati Reds. I listened on radio. It was really an important part of my life. But creatively, SportsCenter was creative because you got to create every night with the highlights. You got the highlight. Now, do you want to add anything to it? How much fun are you going to have with it? What's your angle on these things? So there was always creativity. And then I got to do a lot of the Sunday conversations that ESPN used to do. And then I got to do ESPN radio. There were plenty of outlets. And then I wrote a column, the back page in the magazine as well.
So which would you say, was it just kind of a balance from both, or was SportsCenter, were you able to have more creative freedom with SportsCenter than you were with ESPN radio? Because before, like you commented how ESPN radio was more so almost like an advertisement for everything that ESPN was doing.
Yeah, radio was fun. I just didn't think I did a good job. Whereas SportsCenter, I knew I was doing a pretty good job. I knew we were changing maybe how people viewed sportscasting or that type of show. Radio, I wasn't moving the needle from the standpoint of, I mean, we were in 300 radio stations, but really that's just because of ESPN. I couldn't quite master it. I couldn't quite let myself go. And then when I started to do this 17 years ago on my own, it's like, this is going to be me. Good and bad, warts and all, but it was going to be me. And I never looked back. I think once you sort of say, here it goes, that you have to be prepared for how people are going to react. And I just, honest, that's all. It's, you know, if something, we make a mistake, you make a mistake. If something makes you cry, it makes you cry. Something is serious, something's fun. The interviews that we have, guests we have on, the approach that we have to the show, it's hard to have a bad day. You're walking into a man cave with a basketball court, football field. I got Traeger grills, a golf simulator. I got pinball machines. I got two bars. I mean, if you don't walk in a good mood, then keep walking.
Did you know as a as a radio host at ESPN, did you know that you had more to offer as a radio host than what you were able to do at ESPN Radio?
Yeah. But I was representing ESPN. And therefore, if you're on one of the marquee shows, I thought I had to be careful of what I said, how I said, who I said it to, because I'm part of ESPN. I'm protecting ESPN. And I didn't want to be the news. And now when you're a host, you have to be the news. You have to drive it. It has to be your opinion. And back then, I just didn't think that it was, I was in that position to do it. You know, when Tony, you know, Tony Kornheiser was different. He was a writer who came in and was doing the show. Colin came in and he was just doing radio. It's like they were almost afforded the luxury of, we're bringing you in for your personality. Whereas my personality was really meant for SportsCenter and I was doing radio. And I never really had it transfer that I was going to be able to do my show the way Colin was interjecting his personality and Tony Kornheiser. I was just, I think I was afraid to do it. Afraid that, you know, I'm going to say something and then ESPN's going to be, you know, pissed off about it.
When did you realize your sports centers with Keith Olbermann were turning into something bigger than just anchoring sports highlights?
I think when we met people outside of Connecticut, when we would be at the ESPYs or we'd be in New York or we'd be in Los Angeles, and you were meeting people who were reciting things that you said or they recognized you. I remember TV Guide, when TV Guide was still around, and this was probably mid-90s, and they said the 10 shows to watch, 10 new shows to watch, and Keith and I were one of the 10. And things changed that day because it was like there are people out there who are watching, enjoying, following, athletes. When I'd be on the road, if I was covering the NBA Finals or World Series, athletes knew who you were, would come up to you. So we learned, but we didn't set out for that. We never, ever discussed strategy. We never once said, hey, if we do this, this will happen. Or why don't we do more of this? Never, never once did it. Because every time we came in, we caught up with each other. And then when we did the show, we didn't know what the other person wrote. We wanted to entertain each other. Because you're in a sterile environment. You're in Bristol, Connecticut, in a studio with a floor director and a couple of camera people. We were trying to entertain them. That was it. I was not aware of ratings. We just did it. And in thinking back on it, ESPN didn't want us to succeed the way we did, which is going to sound strange because nowadays they would kill for that because they're all about entertainment. Back then, they wanted us to sort of all fall in line, and SportsCenter was going to be the most important part. You're there to do SportsCenter. It's not, you know, SportsCenter's lucky to have you two doing SportsCenter. And management fought us on that. And we did a lot of things surreptitiously, very clandestine, things that we said or how we said it. It was late at night. We didn't know if our bosses were watching, but that was the fun. There was some danger to it. And then one time we got called in on the carpet and we got read the riot act, but it didn't stop us. It just, I think, made us even smarter of trying to get away with things. Today, they would encourage all of that. And it might go back to the Howard Stern analogy. When you get to do everything, it takes away from a little bit of the mystery, whereas we had to be sneaky in doing it. And I thought that that had that danger element, and it was smart humor. We never wanted to be obvious. We wanted to be snarky, but we also wanted to tap you on the shoulder and say, you know, if you got it, great. If not, it's okay. We'll move on to the next highlight.
So if with ESPN Radio, they kind of similarly didn't want you to necessarily succeed the way you have succeeded now by having more of a personality and freedom with the show, what, when you were at ESPN, gave you the confidence, or who gave you the confidence to be able to push limits and go outside the box with SportsCenter?
Probably Keith Olbermann did, because I think I was so worried about making mistakes and I would watch a re-air of SportsCenter every night. We'd get done, I'd immediately go in and get the tape, and I'd go upstairs, and I'd watch to see what I did wrong. And I remember Keith walked by, and he said, "What are you doing? You got the bleeping job." And he was right. I was searching for perfection, and I should have been searching for, you know, what I was doing right instead of what I was doing wrong. Like, are we having fun? Are we doing it in the way that we want to do this? How's the writing? Because we had to write, you know, our entire show together. But I think then I sort of exhaled a little bit and went, all right. Because Keith would go, "Why aren't you the same person on the air that you are off the air?" And he was right. But I came from CNN, where when I was at CNN, it was the world's most important network. That was their motto. Well, who am I to show my personality on the world's most important network? I'm supposed to be beholden to the world's most important network. And as a result, I think I was always pushing the network first, and it wasn't about my personality. But when you're doing highlights and it's late at night, you want to keep people up. You want them to have fun. You want to entertain them. Then it has to come from your personality. And that really changed my direction of who I was at ESPN. And my first show I ever did was with Chris Berman. And you can't be around Chris and sort of not try to have some fun. You're not going to rival him, but you also have to compliment him and sort of be in the same space. And you can't help but have fun, or you should always have fun.
What was it that happened on SportsCenter that prompted management to call you guys in and read you the riot act?
I think they thought we were getting full of ourselves, that we were getting ahead of those four letters. And they were probably right. But I think you kind of have to push the boundary to know where the boundary is. And that's what we were trying to find out. What is the boundary? And okay, that's it. Now we can work our way back a little bit. But, you know, I'm glad we did it. But I'm glad management said something to us, because I didn't want it to be where we were overt in what we were trying to do. I just loved where it was a little bit of a surprise, a little bit of a mystery, sneaky, subtle. That was always my approach. And, you know, sometimes you play the straight man to Keith, and maybe it's vice versa. But we sort of knew what we were doing without ever communicating what we were doing.
What do you think the future of SportsCenter is? Because obviously younger audiences are getting their sports news and highlights in different ways. Does SportsCenter still serve a purpose?
Oh, it does, because it's still, that's common ground. That's still, if there's a story that breaks and it's sports, you're going to ESPN. That's always going to be there. As long as you're breaking news, you're covering the news, then I think it'll still be a destination. But it's different. When I was there in the mid-90s, when we were really at our peak, there was no social media. You might know the result of a Syracuse basketball game, but you had to tune into SportsCenter to see the highlights. So we had you tuning in. And then it was our job to keep you as long as we could. Now you know what the end result is. You've seen the highlights. Now the challenge at SportsCenter is, what are you going to give me? What is different now? And that's why I think they're trying to be more about entertainment with Stephen A., with Pat McAfee. That's what they're hoping for. But they've had this in the building before. They just didn't want to embrace it. Embrace debate. Now it's embrace entertainment, as Andrew Marchand of the New York Post pointed out. That's what it is. They're trying to get entertainment with the other shows. You know, Van Pelt is very entertaining with his show late at night, but you got revolving anchors, it feels like, in the morning and then in the afternoon and then at 6 o'clock. Scott seems to be that standalone SportsCenter anchor, or they've allowed him to stand alone and become a personality. But as far as handicapping, I have no idea. They haven't asked, let's put it that way.
What do you think about the embrace debate era and like the impact that debate shows have had on ESPN? And and TV in general, because I think First Take and PTI have similarly influenced cable news. It's not just sports shows.
Oh, pardon the interruption, changed everything. Before First Take and Around the Horn, no. Tony and Mike changed TV. That's where news decided to embrace debate, because of those two guys. And they still do it. They still do it in a smart way. They don't yell at each other. You know, Mike occasionally raises his voice, but I mean, those guys, standard bearers for embrace debate. Now, they can take credit and they probably take blame for that as well, because not everybody is as sharp as those guys are. But, you know, with First Take, I don't, it, those are shows that don't entertain me. I like Stephen A, but I don't like to be yelled at. And I don't like that every show feels like it's LeBron James or the Dallas Cowboys. I like to have some variety there. I like shows to cover sports. But, you know, it's like a radio station that plays the hits. That's what they do. They play the hits. These are the topics that we're going to have. Thankfully, I don't have to do that. But do I think it's there for the long haul? I guess. But once again, that's not what I tune in for. I'm not entertained that way. But, you know, younger audiences probably are. You know, Stephen A. and what Skip does, you know, they did it at a high level. And whether you believe that they believed in what they were really saying, that's open to interpretation. But still, they're extremely popular. McAfee, with his approach, with his show, extremely popular and big following. But that's a younger audience that's going to tune into that. You know, they're not playing to me as part of their demo.
Do you think that those shows have too much of a reliance on topics like the Cowboys and LeBron? Like, would they, if they did have more of a variety of topics that they were discussing and debating? And I mean, granted, they do touch on other things, but you're almost guaranteed every single day there's going to be a segment on the Cowboys and a segment on LeBron. Like, would there actually be a ratings drop off if they cut back on those topics?
I don't know, because you're tuning in to hear those people talk about these topics. Or are you tuning in to have those people talk about the topics that you want to hear? I don't know. Sometimes you'll tune in and they'll actually have a genuine conversation. You feel like that it is a genuine conversation or disagreement. But look, I've been behind the curtain there and I know how it works. You take that side, I'll take that side. Or, hey, we both agree on this, let's throw that out. I know that how this works. So I can watch it differently than people who haven't been behind the curtain at ESPN.
When you left ESPN, you left with your own brand, and you've only expanded that. Like, the people that listen to Brady Quinn on the radio, most of them are Fox Sports radio listeners. The people that listen to Dan Patrick on the radio are Dan Patrick listeners. Have you looked at the money that podcasters are getting and ever thought that, considering you have your own brand, that might be a better route for you?
Oh, I don't care.
Really?
No. I this is Monday through Friday. I'm coming out of your radio. I still do a podcast, but this is what I love to do. I'll go out this way. I could do a standalone and, you know, do a podcast and then release it whenever I wanted to, whatever time of the day, but that's not what I want to do. Money is not changing me. This is what I want to do, how I want to do it. And for those who have podcasts and big followings, good for you. This is where I'm comfortable.
So what about it in 4 years when you decide to leave radio? Could you see yourself doing a podcast at that point, a regular podcast?
I'd like to know, let me see where podcasting is in 4 years. Because podcasting has diminished greatly here recently. You have some that are succeeding at a very high level, but, you know, I'm finding that there are a lot of podcasts that are looking for homes. So I don't know what podcasting will be. Will there be something different? I mean, look how quickly podcasting took over. Is there going to be something else that comes along? I wouldn't want to kind of put myself in a corner saying, yeah, maybe I'll do a podcast. Right now, I don't have plans on it, but if I did, maybe it's a once a week type podcast, but even then, I'd be skeptical of that.
Why do you think, right? I don't want to say Keith Olbermann hasn't been successful in his post ESPN career, but he hasn't found a long-term home. And when you look at your post ESPN career, you look at Rich Eisen, Colin Cowherd, even Skip Bayless, are you surprised that Keith never found that long-term home after leaving ESPN?
Yeah, but you know, you have to understand Keith, like what he wants to do. I thought he mastered SportsCenter and then decided that he wanted to start something different at Fox, or maybe he wanted a different change in his lifestyle. But I've never sat down and asked Keith, you know, why have you moved on from different jobs? Because, you know, his ability to be able to master something happens quickly. And then I don't know if he gets bored with it or, you know, what is the challenge? Like, what is it? Quality of life? What he wants to do? I don't know. Those aren't things that I've discussed with him. I just know that I'm loyal to a fault. I stayed at ESPN longer than I should have. I don't regret it, but I know I stayed longer. I was more loyal to them than vice versa. And I'll always be that way. If you believe in me and you gave me a chance and they gave me a chance, and I will always be forever indebted to something like that. But I don't know if, you know, Keith's mindset or approach to a job is what mine is, but mine is I'll figure it out. I'll make it work. And, you know, I'll be back tomorrow.
Did you ever want to get political on your show? Do you like sticking to sports, or, I mean, does sharing a name with the Texas politician, Dan Patrick, does that almost make you less inclined to get political?
Well, I told my audience when I first started, if you're going to come here and you expect sports, you're going to get sports. Other people do politics and they do it far better than we do. And I'm not here to wax poetic about something. If something comes up and I feel like it's pertinent to the show, then great. But I'm not going out of my way to make it seem like I'm the person that should be talking about this or knowledgeable about this. When it comes to sports, I'm pretty knowledgeable. But I told my audience that I would not get political with them. And it's not a cop-out. It's I'm doing a show that I want to do. If you want to listen to somebody who talks sports, then go listen to them. And they have politics in there. Good for you. This is my show. I you know, lean on my strengths, and this is what I do well. But if you want to talk politics and you're doing a sports show, great. Stephen A. can do it all he wants. I have no issue with that. It's his show. I always tell people, if you don't like it, turn it off. This is what I do. This is how I'm going to do it, and I'm not changing. And I do, you know, hate the fact that the lieutenant governor of, you know, Texas shares the same name, and people think that I'm, you know, against old age people. And, you know, during COVID, some things were set, and like you're going, people get mad at me. And I go, that's not me. I didn't say it. That's him. But, you know, people only read just enough. And they're like, Dan Patrick said this. And I go, my wife will say, what did you say on the show today? And I go, about what? About old people. I go, I'm an old person. What are you talking about? So there's no need to get political. The other Dan Patrick's getting political.
Have you ever interviewed a president or a former president?
Bill Clinton, George Bush, senior and junior. And let's see who we've had them come in, but you know, I talked to George W. I mean, we talked Texas Ranger baseball, and then George Bush Sr., we talked Astros baseball. Bill Clinton, we talked football, Arkansas football. I mean, they don't want to talk politics, and I don't want to talk politics. I want to have you talk sports. All the jerseys that Bill Clinton got, I go, where are those? That you know, they'd always give you a jersey at the White House. And I was curious. Are you allowed to, do you have a man cave? But, you know, to be able to talk to them, it's really about finding out what kind of sports fan they are. But it's not to get political. I couldn't care less about playing favorites. And hopefully it doesn't appear that way.
Never interviewed Trump earlier in your career?
I met Donald Trump back in 1983, maybe. Doug Flutie had signed with the New Jersey Generals.
Okay.
I went to Trump Tower when Herschel Walker went to the Generals. I've been in Donald's office before to do an interview with him. Saw him when he was doing The Apprentice. When I was at Football Night in America, I saw him. He came up, said hello, introduced me to Mark Burnett, and said that we should do a show together. And then he left, and I'm standing there with Mark Burnett, who I had no relationship with. And I just said, hey, Mark. And he goes, hey, Dan. And I go, that was awkward. He goes, it always is with Donald. Always is. And that was it. So, yeah, I've had conversations with him, but it's been, you know, sports related.
Is there somebody that you would like to interview that you haven't been able to yet?
Well, I pretty much interviewed everybody I wanted to. I'd like to have another shot at Jordan, but, you know, I got to interview him when he was winning those championships at SportsCenter. And that was one of the highlights of my career, to be able to be there and witness history. That's why I got into the business. I loved, you know, the thought of covering all of these events. And whether it's the Olympics, Super Bowl, World Series, NBA Finals, I mean, all of these events that I've covered for over 40 years, and to be able to be there and talk to Jordan, but to be able to sit down and talk to Jordan and kind of figure out really who that person is behind that person or that brand. That's what would be, you know, the great goal, because it's there. I know that Tiger, I'm fascinated with, but I don't know if Tiger cares about revealing anything. I think Jordan, I could challenge a little bit, and, you know, maybe, and I found that with a lot of athletes, when you interview them, you know, they're competitive. They have to be. You have to be competitive with them. We had Dion on yesterday, and my first question was, how long does a loss stay with you? And he's like, whoa, okay, all right, we're going there. But he just lost. And challenge, that's what I want to, you know, how long's it stay? And he said, it never leaves. How long's a victory stay? And he says, I move on as soon as the game's over. You're trying to get into that person's airspace. And Mike would be fun. Even the business acumen of that. Of being, you know, a successful businessman. When you go to sleep, you're making money. I mean, that's when you're a great businessman. And I'd be curious about that as well. But I don't think I had anybody on my wish list where I go, you know what, got to get him before I'm done.
Do you think you'd be able to get Jordan to open up a little bit? Because it seems like he's a tough person to crack, especially if the person interviewing him is not someone that is in his inner circle.
Oh, I don't think it'll happen. But you asked me if there was somebody I wanted.
Yeah, no, I'm curious. So if you did get him, if you think
if
you
I
actually,
got him,
if
then
you think it would be a good interview? Like, do you think he would be receptive?
I don't think he would do it unless he thought he was going to be good, because there's no reason to do it. If I said, hey, we're going to sit down for an hour, and my goal is we sit down for 2 hours, but if we sit down for an hour, let's talk. And Mike doesn't do anything unless he wants to be great at it. And I don't think that he would sit down and do an interview and not be good.
I think every sports fan and radio host even would agree that you're a very good interviewer, but two of your most famous interviews are Matt Harvey and Kyler Murray. Did you walk away from those interviews just thinking that it was like young athletes getting bad advice, or like do you walk away from those interviews almost feeling a little bit disrespected that they use your platform and kind of waste your time?
No. I mean, Kyler Murray's a kid. I don't think he understood the quid pro quo that goes on in a Super Bowl. You have a product. you get to talk about the product. I get the opportunity to ask you questions. And at the time, we didn't know if he was going to play football or baseball. But that's on him, not on me. Matt Harvey got bad advice. I don't think he understood quid pro quo either. He wanted to talk about Qualcomm as if I was going to have him on just to talk about Qualcomm. This is a guy who's in New York City. You should be a little more aware of that. And he didn't want to talk about his surgery. And I was thinking, well, we're not going to sit here and talk about Qualcomm for 5 minutes. But he was under that impression. That's either bad advice or extremely naive. Kyler, he eventually came back on. He apologized. He laughed about it. I laughed about it. But in the moment, if you're going to freeze up and not say anything, we're going to cut short this interview. And I had no problem doing that. But it's Kyler Murray didn't even know who I was. Matt Harvey might not even know who I am. So it's not like they disrespected me. I just think they weren't any good at what they were doing. And that was sell a product, but answer a couple of questions.
By the time you went to NBC, obviously you're a well-seasoned TV personality. The Big Show was a massive hit earlier in your career, but did hosting Football Night in America feel different? Like, did being part of the NFL feel bigger?
No. I think when you hand out the Super Bowl trophy, the NFL feels bigger, but it was a studio show. I'm doing highlights. I've done highlights all my career. I've interacted with analysts. You're just landing planes. That's all it is. And making sure they take off and land, timing. But that I was really proud to be a part of that product because I loved working with those people, whether it was the people on camera or behind the scenes. And I'd worked with a lot of those people at the Olympics as well. And that was a lot of fun. But that was Sunday night. So I was working 5 days a week, and then I worked Sunday night till 11 o'clock, and then I'd have to turn around. And I'm still loyal to my radio show. And I was burning the candle at both ends there. I loved doing the Olympics as well, but quality of life. Keep coming back to that, quality of life.
Did working on Football Night in America affect at all what you could or couldn't say on your radio show when talking about the NFL?
No. Nobody ever told me anything. And I would not want them to do that. Part of what I was doing, you know, my agreement was when I started on my own and I was affiliated with other networks is you can suggest, but it still comes back to me. And I didn't want to be dictated to. These are partners. So if somebody says, if Mark Lazarus at NBC says, hey, you know, can we be careful about bringing that up? Or, hey, can you promote that? Then fine. We can have a conversation. But, you know, if it happened 3 times, then, you know, that might be at the top end of how many times somebody suggested something. But no, I never felt like I still had to do my radio show. That was more important to me than doing Football Night in America. Hey, got to be careful. Don't criticize the commissioner. Nobody said that. And if they did, that's not the way it works. If the commissioner deserves to be criticized, then he'll be criticized. I didn't go out of my way to go, hey, I worked for the NFL. I'm going to go after the commissioner. If it warranted something, then I'd say something. But no, and to their credit, they brought me in. They brought me in for a reason because I know what I'm doing.
Were you interested in succeeding Alex Trebek on Jeopardy?
Yeah. It was that's the only time where I really had to think hard about, would I leave this? And then I wondered, could I do it? Because Alex worked 50 days out of the year. And he did 5 shows each day on those days that he worked, those 50 days. And that was the first question I asked. That Steve Mosco was running Sony, and he met me in New York and said, look, Alex, we think he's going to retire. And if he does, would you want to do Jeopardy? And I said, I'd be interested in it. And I flew out to L.A. I met with him and his executive producer, Harry Friedman. And then we just sort of waited because they said, if Alex retires, we want you to do Jeopardy. And then Alex decided he was going to stay on. And they said, well, we want to create Sports Jeopardy. And it was on the same set. And it was a great learning experience. And it was fun. And it also gave them an opportunity to see how I would do in the stage with the Jeopardy board and all the things that go with it. I'm thankful that Alex stayed on. We had a great dinner after he decided he was going to stay on. And he never brought up that I might replace him. That was never, ever brought up. I think he wanted to get to know me and allow me to get to know him and take away sort of maybe that awkwardness that could have been there, even though it wasn't. Because, look, he's a gladiator, man. I mean, that guy, you know, had knee replacement. I remember him talking to me, and I said, you got to rehab. I'm watching him on the show, and he's limping. And I remember I called him. I said, you got to do rehab, Alex. If you're going to continue to do, like, I wanted him to do it as long as possible. Because what he does, what he did, is not easy. But he makes it look easy. And I just remember, do I want to do that and do this as well? And I don't, I probably would have given up this to do that because I didn't want to be average at both. I wanted to be great at something.
Were you in the running or did you have discussions about replacing him after he passed away?
No. Steve Mosco left Sony and I wasn't even interested in being a guest host. Like I just didn't want to do it. I'd been there, let other people, if they want to do it, say they got a chance to do it. But I the moment had moved on, whether it was them and me, you know, just like with Price is Right, when they said you have the job, and it was 1999. They called me out of nowhere and they said, hey, do you want to host Price is Right? And I go, who is this? And then, you know, they were, introduced themselves and they said, you know, we want to have you, we'll offer you Price is Right. And I said, I don't want to, cause I was still doing SportsCenter and I said, I'm not interested. And they said, look, we'll set up a set. We'll set up Price is Right set in San Antonio. Cause I was going down there for the NBA finals. And I thought, oh my God. And I said, well, tell me the work schedule. How much does it pay? And they go, if you take the job, we'll tell you how much it pays. And I go, what? And I just, it's not, that wasn't a challenge. I just wouldn't have been interested. And Drew Carey, good for him. You know, he's got the personality to do it. I wouldn't have done it. I wouldn't have done it as well. Jeopardy is challenging. It's interesting. And that would have kept me going. Price is Right would not.
Why is hosting Jeopardy a challenge?
Well, if you knew how to do it and you saw how they do it and everything that goes into it, and you're doing five shows a day, just the information intake is overwhelming. And plus, when people, you know, pick out a category, they just don't go NFL coaches for 100. They'll go NFL coaches for 100, basketball forwards for 800. Like, you're bouncing all around. Well, you got to then find the category on your big sheet that you have with the clue. Make sure you read it correctly. Then you have to listen to what they say. Did they get the clue right? And then, I mean, it happens so quickly. But there is a syncopation that goes along with it that you get into the rhythm there. But it was really, really challenging. And that was sports. I knew probably 70% of the answers, the clues. I can't imagine if I'm talking about Mesopotamia and, you know, great leaders of Mesopotamia.
Did you watch Aaron Rodgers do it at all? Like, do you think Aaron would have been a good host of Jeopardy?
Sure. If he wants to do something, he'll do it well. Yeah. And I knew that he liked it. And he even told me that he loved Sports Jeopardy as well. And I believe that he would have been. Because if you're going to be a quarterback of a team, what are you seeing in front of you? Making decisions. I mean, it's all about read and react quick. This. That's what Jeopardy is. It's there's a clue, answer, right. Boom. Okay. Blah, blah, blah. But, you know, here we go. Another clue. Here we go. And let's take a break. Now we'll go introduce ourselves. Now we'll come back. Now here we go. And then on Final Jeopardy, like it happens so quickly. And if you can process an NFL playbook, then you can do Jeopardy. And I was not surprised at all.
So considering that you don't think The Price is Right would have been challenging enough, like looking back on it, are you almost glad that they didn't give you a number for how much it pays? Because I would imagine that there is a number that would have made you say, yes, I'll do it.
Yeah, I think it was $10 million, but it, once again, it, there's not any amount of money that's going to change my life. And so I, if you took the job for the money, then you're taking it for the wrong reason. Jeopardy, I didn't know what they were going to offer. I didn't care. I never asked. When Steve Mosco said, hey, if Alex retires, we want to offer you Jeopardy. I never said, what's it pay? I said, what's the schedule? Because I wanted to know if I could still do this. I'm sure paid $10 million or more, but that wasn't important because that was the show that I would have done. And Price is Right, if I'm taking it just because the price is right, then it's wrong.
Dan, you were awesome, and we are really glad that we still have 4 more years of the of the Dan Patrick Show. Thank you so much for joining the podcast. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That is Dan Patrick. I'm Brandon Contis. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Please rate and subscribe to this podcast. Please also subscribe to Awful Announcing's YouTube page. But regardless of how you consume Awful Announcing and the Awful Announcing Podcast, thanks for listening and be good.
Thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast. For the latest news spanning the sports media landscape and more, check out awfulannouncing.com and follow us at awfulannouncing.com.